Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Elizabeth and Katie live with the Best Ever You Show, and we are just extremely honored to have CNN's Christine Romans with us. She's the author of the new book, Smart is the New Rich. If you can't afford it, put it down. Right, Christine? How are you?
I mean,
today?
I don't mean put the book down. I mean, if you can't afford something else, put that down. Like, pick up the book.
Definitely pick up the book. Katie, are you there, honey?
Yes. I am here.
Well, sorry.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say how excited I was to do this, too. I don't know if you know this, Christine, but my background is mental health and counseling with people, and money's a hot issue. It's a really powerful issue, and I like that in your book you're offering people a path to making better choices, and I think that's just really great.
I thank you for that. Interesting your background, especially since so much of the research that I did was about couples and money and families and money and how people try not to talk about money, yet it is the thing that is the juice that keeps a family economy going. And so it's interesting how it can be a source of so much strife in American families, especially now after what's happened over the past few years. And I felt like it was pretty important to say, okay, yes, we can talk about money. This is how we should talk about money. And now there's no margin for error for going forward. So now we really need to be having smart conversations about it.
Do you know what your book did for my household?
But
it quieted it down. For years, my husband's a lawyer and he's a securities attorney and he's been in the financial industry for 30 years. And I've got enough of that background to be dangerous as well. And it is the first book that has come into our household that we have both agreed on.
Oh, really?
Yep, absolutely. We took turns reading each chapter, and it is the first book. He said to tell you, all good advice and actionable, no matter what you read, it all makes sense. And and then Katie and
actionable
I were
actionable is what we were really looking for. I mean, I wanted to make sure that it was actionable and that you'd be able to take the advice and use it. And even some things don't pertain to every family. You know, sometimes it's just student debt, and that obviously doesn't pertain to somebody who's getting ready to retire. But I felt like, and as I said in the beginning of the book, my whole goal was to either read it cover to cover, or you could use it as a roadmap just read the bottom of each chapter for just the payoff. Or if you're just interested in what is the difference between good debt and bad debt, and, you know, I need a gut check again about what debt I have is good and what debt I need to get rid of. And so I was hoping that I had enough broad ideas in there that people could get something out of it. Everybody could get something out of it in the family. So I really appreciate you guys were agreeing on it. That's fantastic.
And then, it's just excellent. And then Katie and I were over at my house this morning. And, Katie, were we there for, like, 2 hours? We had, like, a book club moment trying to figure out what all to ask you on the radio. And I have to switch phones, actually. I am on low battery on this phone. Hang on just a minute.
Sure.
Well, she's switching, I'll just tell you, when we were having our conversation this morning, Christine, we were both really kind of almost celebrating the fact that we had been at different places financially and had risen above some of the things that had happened to us. Both of us had been divorced, had to maneuver through divorce and building yourself back up financially after losing a job. And one of the things we were celebrating is the fact that we had done some of the things you had said to do. And so it was a really affirming thing that, wow, you know, people feel so helpless when some of this stuff happens. Can you speak to that? Can you just speak to when someone is in a really bad financial situation and that feeling of I can't do anything, I'm overwhelmed? What do you suggest to those people?
You know, it's all little by little, and it's all taking a little bite of it and moving forward. And it's about knowing that you can fix it. I spent the day yesterday with a couple who dug out of $88,000 of credit card debt. I mean, that sounds insurmountable. When I went there, I thought, there's no way these people are going to be able to, I'm never going to believe that they could do this. And I'll tell you, it was amazing how they did it. And it's exactly what we say in the book. It's exactly what, you know, I say on TV. You got to take one little bit at a time and move one step forward, and it's not going to happen overnight, but know that you're smart and that you can fix it. And as soon as you start fixing the things that you can control, because there's a lot that's outside of people's control, and I always feel bad when it's a medical problem that causes a lot of debt or causes financial strife, or if it's a job loss, a downsizing, you know, those things are so out of your control that you're playing defense. When you can start playing offense on little parts of your finances, that's the best thing. And the first thing to do is to control your spending and expenses. The first thing to do is to sit down and do a budget. And the first thing that I always recommend, that it feels so good, you make a list of 10 things, 10 categories that you spend money on, fixed expenses and also discretionary expenses, and cut 10% out. Just cut 10% across the board. And you'll be surprised. You can do it. You can do it. You can absolutely do it. We all have a little bit of bubble in our lives and spending. And then when you start to take control like that, you can do it, and it starts to feel good, and then you really get the momentum.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Are you back, Elizabeth? Okay.
Yeah, I am back. Sorry about that. That we have little goofs like that on Blog Radio. It's very fun. It keeps it real. speaking of real, the one thing that I just absolutely just adore about you is that you are real and you are reachable. And it's you and your Facebook, and you love it when people ask you questions and you go on air with them. And can you speak to your fans and so forth about where you are on Facebook and so forth like that, so people can actually talk to you?
I do. I have a personal Facebook account, and I have a fan page that it's sort of difficult, but on the personal. Facebook account, I really do. I talk to people and I listen to what they have to say, and I really enjoy the comment threads that other people go back and forth. And some people have told me that they have become sort of pen pals. That's such an old-fashioned term, but pen pals with other people who are responding to money questions and money discussions on my Facebook page. And I really enjoy that. I mean, I really enjoy that other people have made connections talking about their trials and triumphs over money and money issues. And I've just started doing them. Maybe the past year I've been doing Twitter, and that is a lot of fun. And I mostly do it in the morning when I'm on air and I'm reporting, and so it's sort of the reporter's notebook. It's the stuff that doesn't really make it doesn't. It's too casual to go on a formal report on television, but it's a little nugget here or there, or a headline that I thought was interesting, or a link that I thought was really important for people, but I'm not necessarily reporting on it that day. And I've had a lot of fun doing that too, sort of having a running conversation with people and listening to other people's conversations. So that's. I really enjoy that. And I go on, I like to hear people's stories, particularly about mortgages and digging out of debt. Anybody who's listening now who, you have a great story of what's happened in your mortgage and getting a modification despite all odds, or you've refinanced, after a year of trying, or you've been able to get out of a bunch of debt, I want to hear your story. I love to tell those stories. And because people are doing it. People are doing it. Despite everything that's happening, people are making it. And I think that's incredible. I like to share those stories.
Well, one of the things I always think about, we refinanced this year, and my husband is like a badger. He is like going after people constantly. He is so a terrier, really. He will not stop. And that's what it took. It took 6 months of really staying on the phone, calling back, insisting to talk to someone else, because they were dragging their feet. And I think that, since we talk to a lot of moms on our show, the little engine that could is really what this is about. It's about
that idea
that you can. And if you talk to one person and they blow you off, you talk to another person. And I know that I have worked with families in the worst of tragedies, and they are left feeling so overwhelmed. But what helps them is exactly what you say in the book. It's one step at a time. I can make this phone call, and if this person says no, I can talk to somebody else.
Right.
And I can keep doing something that works. And eventually you get to a person who listens. And I think that's
about
a big part of it.
It totally is. And when you talk about one step at a time, especially when I'm talking to people about debt, you didn't go all in with a bunch of debt it's in one big fell swoop, and you're not going to get out in one fell swoop. You know, it's all.
Right.
And I also think that when people are having money problems, a way to think of it is this: you have to think of dealing with your financial issues as a part-time job. Because you're going to work it like it's a part-time job. And you have to just understand that at the beginning that you're going to be putting in hours and that sometimes you're not going to – some days are not going to be very rewarding and you're going to feel like you took two steps backward. But that is what it takes to get back on track and to make sure that your financial situation is solid and that your future is going to be okay. You've got to put in time and you've got to invest time in it. And sometimes you have to ask for help too. And I'm not one of those do-it-yourselfers DIY, you know, DIY investments, because I feel like, gosh, I don't give myself my own root canal. I certainly shouldn't give myself my own financial makeover. You know, I need to have a professional who's seen a lot of different teeth and knows what I'm heading for. So I really am a proponent of fee-based financial advisors once a year getting a gut check on where you stand and making sure you have your plan and sticking to it. You know, somebody who you trust, who you pay whatever, $200 for a checkup, and that person isn't trying to sell you anything. They're not trying to sell you any other securities, or they're not trying to sell you life insurance. They're just somebody who's taking a look and making sure that you're moving in the right direction. And that's that's been very helpful to me. Even with just so much research about money, you know, going to someone else and saying, okay, wait, I'm on the right track here, right? And getting the affirmation from that is worth every penny.
Yeah.
If you're not on the right track and you're in a reactive situation rather than a proactive situation, what do you think are some of the first steps that you can take to recognize, uh-oh, I'm in trouble and I need help? Because I think a lot of times when people are in trouble, one of the first things they feel might be embarrassment or shame, guilt, and so forth. And I think this could probably be a question almost for both of you, if you want. But Christine,
this happens all the time where people just stop looking at the bills and they stop answering the phone and it's bill collectors or it's they've got a kid heading to college, they don't have any money and they haven't planned for it and they're suddenly here. I love you, Finn.
I love the baby in the background.
They're so overwhelmed, and you just, again, it's a control issue. You have to know the number. What is the number? What's the damage? I got to know exactly where things stand, and I have to be empowered by knowing where things stand, and then I'm going to fix it one little bit at a time. So I think the very first step is getting a full global view of where you are, what's coming in, what's going out, what are the assets, what are the liabilities, what do I do well and I enjoy that I can make money doing extra, and that's what you have to do. You have to just get you have to know what you're facing before you can, you have to know where that dragon is and what it looks like before you can slay it. So, you know, find it and know the number. And a lot of, you'd be surprised how many people, they know vaguely that they're in trouble, and until the foreclosure notice comes or until the credit card, you know, interest rate is at 30% and they can't borrow any more money, they really don't even know how much money they owe.
Yeah, the head in the sand. Yeah, and really human behavior is such that it's so easy if you fall into shame and guilt. Shame and guilt are really useless emotions. All they do is paralyze us. And if people can understand that if they can rise above when they start to feel embarrassed or shamed or guilty, those are just toss those feelings, toss those emotions, toss those thoughts and say, no, I'm doing something good right now. I'm going to make the best of what I can do today. And I think that's what Best Ever You is all about. It's about taking your situation and making the best of every moment. And I think that's what your book really speaks to, is that we can all do something better.
And I think, you know, in the book I have this whole section about, or this analogy, I keep going back, I guess it would be a metaphor, not analogy, but going back to this idea that your financial well-being is like nutrition or your health.
Yes. Yep.
We often don't think of it that way. Here we are where we watch what we eat or we diet to make sure at certain times that, oh no, I think I've gone too far, or I want to be really healthy and I'm going to eat organic bananas and I'm not, you know. But we spend all this time treating our body like a temple, or this is the one body we have to get us through to the very end. But we don't give that kind of time and attention to our financial situation, mm-hmm. which is essentially the fuel for the body. You know, you only have one chance to accumulate and then to draw down wealth to get you through the very end, and we're so cavalier about it in a way.
Yeah.
And I always think that if we thought about it more like our health, then we want good health and we want good financial health because we want to be healthy and strong and have a lot of options until the very end. And it's
right.
kind of the same sort of concept.
Absolutely. Like, if you reach for the pair of shoes, it's like reaching for the chocolate. You're going to pay later.
Now.
And
I
everything
reach
in moderation
and
is
chocolate.
Okay.
We were out yesterday, Christine. I was out shopping, and my son's like, "Mom." You know? I'm like, "All right." He was so cute. You know, just how do you teach your kids through role modeling and so forth to be good with their money? There's a very large section in your book, and we're all moms here of many kids. I think combined we have 8 children between just us 3 on the phone here. What do we do as responsible parents to teach our kids good money values?
That's such a great question, and I love this question. And the reason I love this question is because I truly believe that all kids are wired differently about money. So there are things that you can do with one kid, and it's not going to work the same on the other kid. So this is where stellar parenting comes into play, you know, because there isn't a rule book for how to teach different kids, but there are some important guidelines for this. And I'll tell you that my advice about teaching kids good money habits goes way beyond allowances. I think allowances is just you can do whatever you want with allowances. I mean, that's just up to an individual family. And because the really important thing is that they have responsibility and they follow through on the responsibility. There was a Charles Schwab family and money survey earlier this year that found that parents of children who were made to take out the trash, you know, from the age of like 10 on, later in life looked back and found that their children, their children were very good with money. There's this correlation between household chores, mm-hmm. paid or unpaid, it didn't matter, but that the child knew that he or she had a responsibility in the family, that responsibility was a cost of acceptance and part of the whole package, and that child was made to follow through on it. Those people grow up to be good with money. And it's just a very mm-hmm. interesting correlation. So I guess it's easy that it follows if you give your kid everything and you don't make them do anything, they're going to be, you know, they're going to expect to have things handed to them and they're not going to be good with money. The other thing is that kids need to be told that they have to contribute to the big things. For example, they can get a lot of money from grandma and grandpa on Christmas or their birthday or an important holiday. That's fine. I mean, that really is fine. You're not spoiling them. But then when they want this $300, you know, a video game machine, or they want something expensive, they have money saved and they help contribute to that. And that is such a good way to teach them money too. And it's funny. Other studies have shown when a child has to contribute some of their own saved money to buy a big purchase, many, many times they change what it is that they want. When they have an investment in it, it changes what their wants are. When we just give it to them, they want different things. It's fascinating. And as I have very little children, so as I watch them, I wonder, you know, gosh, all this research I've done, I'm going to watch these kids and see how they are. It's tricky too because they're little kids. They know how to get what they want.
As a mom of teenagers, I have 2 teenagers. They're 13 and 15, and then I have an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. You are so right. I've never heard anybody say that before, and that's really good advice, that they are all different, and they are all very mm-hmm. much wired differently, even in their activities. My kids are all 4 different people. And the older one did exactly what you just said as well. He wanted to buy a new headset for his Xbox, and it's $150 or so. And we said, well, you know, here's what we'll contribute. Here's what you get to contribute. And all of a sudden, that headset didn't become very important. He completely said, you know, I think I can kind of live without this and just use my old one. And
he
put the money
very
in his
smart.
Bank account. Yeah, and we did I don't know if this is right or wrong. What do you think about this? We gave each of our children, we set up each bank account for each of our children, and it's a savings account, and they issued ATM cards for the older children.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great idea. I think you should know what they're spending the money on. But, yeah, I think it's a great idea. And you can also get a debit card that is tied to your debit card that you get a text or a alert, an online alert, when your child uses a debit card. It tells you where they used it and for how much. So
that's
you can monitor their spending, too. And
yeah,
that's, I think that's a great way. It's a great way to do it. I also, another great thing to do is, and you can do that. There also are prepaid cards. You can put, you know, $100 on a card or something, and you can also get it tied so that you get a text message for what it is that they or an email for what it is that they've spent the money on. But I have found that kids really are learning a lot about financial literacy through iTunes, through buying songs. You know, they've got $20.
Yeah.
They have to figure out which songs they want and what's the value of, and that's for younger children. Especially, you know, that's a really good way to teach them about money too. But, you know, there are some financial analysts who I've even quoted in my book who are a little more old school, and they say, you know, you give your kids whatever money you give them, then they have three envelopes. One is for saving, one is for spending, and one is for charity. And the child has to divvy up the money, and then you keep the spending envelope in your purse, and they use cash. But kids, I mean, they're growing up in an age when they're not really using cash. They're using, everything's electronic, you know. So I really do like the debit card where the parents can see what's going out the door. And then you can discuss about their spending. You know, you can discuss what they're spending it on. I really do like that idea.
Well, and I think you brought up another good point, too, and that is charitable giving, because right now we're collecting for UNICEF, and my daughter just loves doing that every year. And that's another opportunity to bring awareness to financial issues and giving back. And I think that's another thing that teaches financial well-being is also giving away what you can.
I could not agree more. And
contribute.
I'm almost non-negotiable on this, because I've worked with a few financial planners who, for example, a gentleman named Ryan Mack, who is someone who I trust so much. He gives financial literacy seminars a lot of different places, and he sits down with people. You know, his mother is a woman who they grew up in projects and on subsidized by the government, and she managed to, on a very slim salary, you know, working two jobs, you know, move out of that situation, save money, and actually move ahead solidly into the middle class. And all along the way, she gave away 15% to the church. And, you know, this is something that he and many other people are there. You have to, no matter what your circumstances are, there's somebody who has less circumstances. And giving away and giving in charity are just such an important part of the human experience from day one that should always be a part of your budget. And it's interesting, when I've had people help me do mock budgets for the book or for other things or for stories, they, to a person, when they're doing a budget, there's always a line there for giving. No matter how much is coming into the household, there's always a line there about how much should go out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's a good point.
So I wanted to
go ahead.
Do you want? Okay, I wanted to kind of go back, just shift gears slightly, and just ask you, how did you get to be where you are today? It's so neat to see you on CNN, and you know, we went to high school together, and you knew you were really neat in high school. You just knew you were so smart, and you were headed somewhere, but. You know, back then, none of us knew what any of us were going to end up doing, or, you know, that we'd be talking on the phone right now even. So did you know what you were going to do back then?
No, I didn't. I loved journalism. I loved current events. I shouldn't say journalism. I loved current events. I loved news. We would get Time Magazine. I would devour it. You know, it would come in the mailbox. I'd sit there and read the whole thing. And we would do these current events bowls and problem-solving bowls, you know, and all these you know, geeky little brainiac clubs and stuff. And I mean, I always loved that stuff when it was about politics international news, you know, current events, never money really, but all those other things. And then when I went to college, I took a journalism class and was just completely hooked and just kept following down the path. When I came out of college, it was in the recession. I graduated in 93, so there was a recession in 91, and a friend of mine who had graduated out in the recession, he said, you got to stay away from newspapers. You got to find a trade. You have to find a specific thing to be good at. And he said, what are you good at? I said, well, I'm good at math, but I don't like it. And he said, you should get into business news. And so I started looking around for business news jobs, wire service jobs, and got a job in Chicago covering Chicago for Reuters. It was actually at first, the first job was Knight Ridder Financial News. And I was covering financial markets, and they trained me. They said, I'll never forget, I said, I don't know anything really about economics. You know, I'm a liberal arts major. And they said, no, we can teach a smart journalist economics. We have a harder time teaching economists journalism. So I started learning about markets and economics and asking a lot of questions, and, you know, real entry-level job, and just kept every new opportunity that came my way, I took it, no matter what it was. I just took the new opportunity. Never agonized, just a new opportunity came, I'd take it. And that's how I got here. I just kept moving. I never really sat still. And when the first time they ever put me on TV, I had never had a desire to be on television. I just loved news. And the first time they ever put me on TV, it was because nobody else in the newsroom wanted to do it. No one else wanted to do it.
That's a great spot to be in, a little nerve-wracking.
Yeah. So I was the youngest, and they said, well, you Romans, you got to do it because nobody else wants to. And I said, well, yeah, sure, I'll do it. I mean, I'll do it. And so I did, and they called me, the next day from New York. I was in Chicago. They called me from New York and said, we want you to move to New York as soon as you can. We'd like you to train you to be a television reporter. And I said, okay. Once again, it was an opportunity. I said, sure, I'll do that. And so I just kept, every time something happened, they said, do you want to go on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and do the opening bell? And I said, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And I just kept saying that every time something came up. And here I am.
Yeah, it sounds like you have just a wonderful attitude toward life. How did you find time to write this book? You're a mom of three boys, right?
Yes.
Three boys. How
when
was
I
that,
started then? The book, I was the mom of two boys. And how did I find the time? Well, I knew from the crisis and the months after the crisis, I learned more from the run from maybe 2005 until 2009 than any other four-year period of my life, bar none. I mean, the run-up to the crisis, I was doing these series of reports called War on the Middle Class, and we were watching what was happening to we were watching what it looked like the world was in a boom, but all of these things were coming unraveled for average families, average American families. And I was doing all of this work on this, and I thought maybe I wanted to write a book about that. And then the financial crisis happened. And in those days and months after, it was just nonstop incredible. It was incredible. I just learning something new every day and meeting new people and telling the stories about what was happening across the country. So I knew I wanted to write a book. Then I got the book deal and found out I was pregnant in the same week.
Yeah,
and so then I was
talking
like,
about that. Yeah.
This is going to be a brutal, brutal 5 or 6 months. So I just plowed ahead. And this is my attitude. And since you guys are moms, you really understand this. I thought about it this way. My life was already full. My time was already full. And I was trying to layer on this writing a book on top of it. And I just said to myself, I'm about to have a newborn baby. And a newborn baby demands your attention constantly. Nothing is more time-consuming than a brand-new baby. So I have to treat writing this novel like I have a new baby. So I basically just plowed through it. I wrote it in the middle of the night. I wrote early in the morning. I wrote in the afternoon. Sometimes I would write. I mostly wrote every day from 2 until 12, maybe 1:30 until 3, before I left the office, I would close my office door, pull the blinds, and plow through. And then my husband, every Saturday, took the two little boys on the train to Coney Island, and they had this wonderful ritual together. We'd all get up, have breakfast, they'd get on the train, go to Coney Island, and I had 2 hours to write. And I did my best writing on those Saturdays. Then they would come in, hi, Mommy, and then that was it for the weekend. I would not write anymore for the rest of the weekend. So I would just made myself have those 2 hours. And then some of the time during the week. But what was so funny about it, too, was writing. People would say to me, you know, how do you deal with writer's block? And I'd say, I have two toddlers. I don't have the luxury of writer's block. I mean, writer's block is something you have when you're, I got to write. I mean, when they walk out the door and the door closes behind them and they're getting on the train, I know I have exactly 2 hours to get this chapter done, and there is no writer's block. It's like there's a fire under me, and I am moving.
That is hilarious. When you write a book like this, do you just write and go for it and not worry about any, you know, punctuation or spelling and all that stuff? Is the mission to just write?
Oh, that's a good question. No, because I used to be a copy editor at a newspaper, and once you've been a copy editor at a newspaper, it's almost like a curse for the rest of your life that you can't read a menu and you can't write something without really just being so irritated by punctuation and that kind of stuff. It's one of the things about Facebook. No, but it's one of the things about Facebook and Twitter that's been so liberating for me, because sometimes I write in lowercase now, and sometimes I put an ellipses where it should be a period, and I feel as though I've been liberated from my copy editor-ness. I tried to do it as cleanly as I could because I was on such a tight deadline, and I was terrified I was going to have a baby before it was done. So I wanted to make sure that I wanted to make sure that it was as clean as it could be on the way out, because I didn't want to get in a situation where I had a baby 3 weeks early or something, and I wasn't there to go back and fix up stuff that I knew that I wanted to fix. And I was lucky, too, because, you know, and there were punctuation mistakes anyway, and I went through. I also, after writing three chapters, I stopped and went back and started all over again because I had thought of a different way to format it. And so I just sort of, I did a lot of labor and then threw it out and started over. But when I did that, it was better and it was cleaner and it was easier to write that way when I had a good structure in my mind. So that made it a little bit easier.
Well, and I think what people don't realize when you write a book is the way that you learn how to write a book is by writing a book. You write.
Yeah.
You learn to write by writing. And
yeah,
by
exactly
trial
right.
and error and writing and writing and rewriting and rewriting. And I think that when people start to write a book, or they don't even think about, well, I could never do that. But you can. It's just that you have to be willing to put the time in, and the rewriting is really the essence of what writing a book is all about. And that's a good point. And I think one thing that strikes me in listening to your story is that you have just got some tenaciousness. I mean, you are really tenacity. You have tenacity, man. You are like, I'm going to do it. Where do you get that from, Christine? Where's your tenacity from?
I don't know. I don't know, actually. I
remember
you
always being like that, though.
Really?
I think
something about deadlines. When I give my, I guess it's been 15 years of working under deadlines. Is I give myself a deadline and I get to it. And I remember when I was in college, I was a student newspaper editor, and after at the end of the year, they had this little award ceremony, and they said you're the only editor to ever have put the paper to bed on time, you know, every night. And I thought, well, there was another option. I didn't know that there was another option, you know. I guess I'm kind of a rule follower, and so maybe that comes off as tenacity. But I give myself a deadline, and then I got to do it.
Well, and I think what you were talking about earlier with kids and kids, you know, approaching money differently, and it's all tied together. People who are boundaried and make decisions based on goals and follow through, and they tend to be the people who will follow a budget. It's folks who are hard, that's more difficult for, that's more of a challenge. I think that's where incremental change comes in, because if you think about doing everything all at once, it's overwhelming and you can't do it. But for some people, if you just take one step of structure at a time, and for many, especially women, that might be just changing your thinking pattern around, you know what, I'm going to try this. It may be scary, it may be hard, but I'm going to do it anyway. And so I think what I'm hearing from you is when people provided you with opportunities, you didn't think about being afraid. You just did it. And and I think
a lot
of times fear really paralyzes people. And one question I wanted to ask you about, because it's really been on my mind lately, especially as we're facing the election and there's so much backstabbing and pushing and all kinds of stuff happening and negativity. And can you speak to the fear around money? Because I think right now there's a lot of reporting about what's not good, what's scary, what's fearful, and that is really perpetuating people having a bad attitude about money and being afraid that they're going to lose it, and people who have it not being willing to share it, and people who don't have it feeling like they never will. And can you speak to that by any chance?
Yes, I can, because I've done actually a good deal of research on this. And, you know, the number one reason why people are afraid of money is because someone who is close to them has lost it. And they're seeing it firsthand all around them. And that's why, I mean, all these political analysts know that that's what people are taking with them into the voting booth. And that's what all these, you know, ad gurus who are doing these negative ads, they know this too. They know, you know, if you're an incumbent, you know that somebody is walking into the voting booth and they know somebody who's been out of work for a year. And they know someone who has a foreclosure. And they know that their kid has $25,000 of student loans, and it has no job prospects this year. And that, it's this fear of having that happen to you because you've actually seen it. So it's a real fear, and it's interesting that you say too about the reporting that perpetuates negativity. When I do stories about how, you know, companies say that they have all this cash on hand and that they think in the next 6 to 11 months that they'll begin hiring again, you know, once they are convinced that a recovery is in place, the feedback I get is that's not true. They're not going to, it's never going to turn around. It's not going to turn around. And you're just all searching for something positive to say because it's just been the steady drumbeat of the same unchanging job situation. And now you're trying to find glimmers of hope on the margin, and it's not real, you know. So people are so battle scarred. I would say people are so battle scarred, and I know that I've talked to some executives in the big banks too, and they've seen this. They've seen that people with money are not spending money like they used to, or making investments, investments in their companies, or not spending money the way they could, because they don't want to be caught short again. And so it's interesting that there's a whole I think that you're heading into, and I'm not making this is I think the conference board came up with this phrase, but they said that there's going to be frugal fatigue, and it's going to give way to some very strategic consumerism. I would say strategic consumerism is probably a good thing, because we had absolute willy-nilly consumerism for too long is what got us in this mess. But people are really scared, even if they don't need to be. And I don't know what changes that. I just don't know when it changes and what changes. Maybe time heals all wounds, and it's only time that will change that.
Well, I think it's a combination. I think it's time, but it's also willingness to tell those stories, regardless of what people say, because somebody like myself would love to hear more of those stories. Because actually my experience has been in watching people lose, they gain something so important, which is they identify what's most important to them. I mean, I've known people, and myself included, when my husband and I both lost our jobs, all of a sudden you're faced with this situation of, you know, what's most important to us? What can we give up? What are we going to lose? But what are we gaining? And so I think the more stories like you're talking about, the more people learn how to change their thinking from fear-based to proactive.
I was just going to add that.
Go ahead.
I can't see you, so I can't tell when you're pausing. But I was going to say that, you know, on the phone right here, just between us, your husband, you, me, and my husband, Christine, we've all lost our jobs.
Mm-hmm.
All four of us have lost our jobs, so we've had to really change. That's why Best Ever You exists, is because, you know, I lost my job a few years ago, and then my husband lost his job a few years ago. We both lost our jobs pretty much within 6 months of each other. And so these are the things we do in times of chaos and so forth. And
well, we become entrepreneurs and we innovate and we come up with new ideas. And that's where, you know, we really try to, you know, I don't know what the innovation and the entrepreneurship that will come out of this will be, but you've got to hope that there are people out there coming up with. And, what, you know, and I'll tell you, when I talk to college students and I ask them, you know, so are you really, gosh, are you guys bummed out that two out of every ten kids of the class of 2010 had a job offer? I mean, that means eight of them are still, you know, hanging around.
And they're competing
with the class of 2009 for jobs. And I ask, and they're not ever negative about it. Their parents are freaking out, but they're not ever negative about it because they've never had a lot of money to spend before. You know, they're not having to cut back. They're just waiting and pausing before they get started. And they, I think, are going to be a real key to unlocking what will be the future growth of the economy.
Is the job situation for college graduates right now as bad as it was back in 1991 when I graduated, or 93 when you graduated? Because
yeah,
I
it's
remember
worse.
Having oh, I when we when I graduated, my husband and I graduated from college at the same time, my first husband, and I remember us having a calendar because we thought, you know, we're going to graduate and instantly get, you know, $50,000 a year jobs and we'll be fine, and we were both working at Walmart.
Yeah. It was, you know what? Let me tell you, Elizabeth, that those jobs, there's too many kids to get those to share those jobs. I mean, there isn't a service industry job. They're not even getting those jobs. It's a really in the book. You know, I talk a lot about when the kid's at home. Like, how does the baby boomer parent handle it? Or the young boomer parent handle it when the kid is back at home and you know the jobs prospect is so bad. I mean, we are essentially Generation X, so we got out of that 91 and 93 debacle, and then the economy created 24 million jobs over 10 years. And then it became sort of like Generation X, you were crazy if you couldn't get a job because there were just so many jobs.
Yeah.
And we've lost 8.5 million for Generation Y, and we are still not even keeping up with new population growth. So the prospects for this generation are just so abysmally worse than they were for us in 91 and 93. And I'm going to tell you something. So Tom Brokaw made a comment on Blog Talk Radio. I think Nancy Taylor, I can't remember who was the interviewer, but he recently did an interview, and she asked him, what was your advice for people going, you know, people coming out of school? And she said, maybe a directionless college graduate or somebody who doesn't really know what they want to do. And he said, you need to be looking overseas. You need to look to India. You need to look, you know, they need China, mm-hmm. American companies in China need middle managers. You need to look to the middle, to Dubai. You need to look to, and I was so struck by that, and I talked about it on air. I was so struck by that, wow, that's just not feasible for most families. You know, how do you get the visa? How do you get the kid hooked up with a company in India? How do you, you know, that's such a great idea if the kid gets a job at an American company and then gets transferred or something. But how do you tell 1.5 million people from the class of 2010 to go to Dubai or to go, you know, I mean, it just, if that's our only sort of avenue of hope, I'm so worried. I'm so worried.
Yeah.
So I don't know what it's going to take for this thing to turn around. I do know that we are turning into a nation of what I call it in the book permalancers, but contract workers, companies having, you know, lots of temporary contracts with people. And I think kids are going to have to find out how to become an independent contractor and find something you're good at and get a company who needs you to do it for them. Because they're really kind of skittish on the hiring. And another thing I say in the book is that 80% of all the job openings are never advertised. It's all an underground market known by who knows.
Yep.
And so they have to be working real hard to make those connections.
Well, and I'm helping someone right now try to find a job in the social service area. And one of the things I've recommended to a lot of kids is AmeriCorps. And being willing to take a step towards further training that gets your foot in the door in smaller companies that you can work your way up. And I think that's hard. I mean, it's hard for them to think about, in a sense, moving backwards, but they're really not. If you're doing something in the market, you're luckier than a lot that are doing that just can't find anything.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I
you
think
have
part
to have
of it
that,
is,
that. that hole on the resume has to be filled. I mean, yeah. Especially if you're from the class of 2009 and there's nothing that you can put on there that's like a meaningful learning experience or a charity, or, you know, a charity or volunteer experience. I mean, you've got to fill that time. And yeah. It is so important because there are literally hundreds of thousands of bright, well-rounded kids out there who are all competing for these jobs, and you've got to have something interesting on that thing. And you know, it's interesting that a recruiter told me that some of the really good colleges and the Ivies have been looking for when they're trying to pick the kids to go into college, they've been looking for the retail experience, the Walmart and the McDonald's experience as part of the rounding out an upper middle class student before they come in.
Oh.
Because they
wow.
are, they really want, and I can't, you know, and I'll tell you another thing that same recruiter told me, don't send me one more kid who spent the summer in Costa Rica saving the turtles.
Yep. Yep.
That just
yep.
says to them,
yeah.
too much money,
yep.
too much money, too much money. Give me the kid
yep.
who went and was a line cook at McDonald's. I was
yep.
so shocked because there are
yeah.
all these, you know, it's just such an interesting.
Hi, Mommy.
I love you, Finny.
Hi, Mommy.
Yes.
We love her, too. Oh, it's so cute. Okay, so speaking about college, Christine, with four boys going into college, I wrote this article a while ago for the Press Herald here in Maine, and it was mm-hmm. some unbelievable amount, like $80,000 a month that I would have to save to put my kids through college.
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't know.
I
believe
right.
it.
You can double check my math, but
it would be, you need to send. Yeah, you need to save like $200 a month per kid for 10 years each, and then you have covered about a $30,000 education, I think. I might be a little off my money, but it's the financial aid people always say, you know, you need to be putting away $200 a month per kid for about a decade ahead of time, or
and
you're going to be...
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I said, or you're going to be paying that much in interest on what you've borrowed later. So I mean, it's and then there are always people who, you know, I'll tell you, there are always people, Elizabeth, who tell me, well, why should I be saving? Because the financial aid office can just see how much money I've saved, and they're going to take every darn penny of it. And I get that. I understand that, and it makes me a little nervous, too, that you know you save the money, and then they see it, and they're like, okay, we'll take all that. Thank you. And you get less financial aid. But
yeah.
I don't really want to take the risk that I'm going to come up short somehow, and then I'm not going to get the best education that I want for my kid, you know?
Yeah.
And if you've got the means to do it, to put the money aside early, I guess we just all have to do it. I'm upset about, and this is not a controversial statement. They can quote me. Anybody can quote me on this forever. But I just think it's highway robbery the way higher education, the inflation in higher education. It's up something like 300% since 1982. It's just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous.
Just,
and,
it is.
And thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
For 15 years, like the part of the housing bubble was people taking money out of their houses and in home equity loans so they could send their kid to college. And now the house is not worth it. The money has been spent, and you still have to pay that much money for college. I mean, it just kills me that it's so expensive. But you really, I guess we're stuck in a corner. There's nothing you could do about it. You've got to have that education, and then. You know, you got to figure out a way to pay for it. So we haven't fixed that yet, but I just wish that the tuition inflation was something they could get under control. I really wish they could.
Yeah, I was going to chime in. I just paid off my student loan when I turned 40. That's how long it took to pay off my student loan. And then I joke with my kids that they should each pick a sport like badminton and get a scholarship.
Right, something obscure,
like
right?
Badminton, archery, fencing, and ping pong.
It's true.
It'll be good.
It's true. Well, you know, some of the big expensive schools have already. So if you, I have it in the book, but I think Stanford is one of them. There's a few of them. I'm pretty sure Princeton, maybe Yale. But if your family makes less than $200,000 a year, they're going to work with you. They're going to do an income based education now because they really want economic diversity in their classes in some of these great schools. So that's that's moving in the right direction. It really is.
Yeah.
And the President Obama signed in healthcare reform. A lot of people don't know this, but a big part of healthcare reform was really remaking student loans in this country. And now, starting in the class of 2014, so this might.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I think her phone might have hung up.
Oh, it did.
Are you there?
She's there.
Yeah,
yeah,
great.
Oh,
there we
sorry.
Go.
Okay.
There we go. So starting in the...
Blog radio.
I know. No, that was my son. He came right over and he said, hi, Mommy, and just hung up the phone. Starting in the class of 2014, those kids are going to be able to... If after 10 years they are a nurse or a firefighter or in a social worker or a defense, you know, like a public lawyer, a public defender, their student loans are going to be wiped out. The government's going to wipe them out. So that's amazing.
Oh.
Yeah, and it got completely lost in healthcare reform. But for people who go to college, rack up a lot of debt, there are some pretty favorable income-based repayment that mean hopefully some smart, wonderful, giving people will be a public defender instead of going into corporate law right away because they're burdened by these student loans. They'll be able to go and become a public defender, pay off those loans, and really it'll be good for the economy, it'll be good for people. So there's some really interesting things in there. So if for kids going to school after 2014, there are some better, more favorable student loan laws.
Go
ahead, Katie.
Well, no, I was gonna ask about the sandwich generation issue, but go ahead if you have something else.
Well, yeah, just one thing. I was just going to remind everybody that this is Christine Romans on the phone with us, and she's the author of Smart is the New Rich. If you can't afford it, put it down, and not the book, but but other things. And what I was going to ask you, Christine, is you were, before we went on air, you were going to tell this great story about your dad and him being in Iowa at the bookstore, and I was wondering if you could share that with us.
Oh, yeah. So the whole writing this book was, it was hard, of course, and all this work is done, and then finally the book is available, and I just didn't really hit me that somebody maybe who I don't even know was going to buy a book that I wrote and want to hear all these things that I had to say. I felt like I really needed to say all of this stuff, but, you know, it just was really, really humbling, and I saw somebody in my Borders in the Time Warner Center. I was walking in there. I was just sort of peeking and checking and seeing the books there, and I saw somebody pick up my book and buy it. Somebody I don't know pick up my book and buy it. I couldn't believe it. And then my dad said he was at the Borders in the Quad Cities, and he said to the guy who was, you know, moving the books around, the guy who worked there, he said, you know, this is a local author. You know, maybe you should move it up front. With my dad out there, you know, trying to get my book moved to the front of the store. And the guy said, oh, no, it's fine. I'm telling you, people have been coming in. We know she must be local. People have been coming in buying this thing. And I just thought, wow, he was so proud, and then I was so proud, you know, and it was just really a fun, cute moment, the idea of my dad walking to the bookstore trying to put it up front.
Yeah, it's dad's for you. with 7 minutes left to talk to you, I know we need to do many more phone calls with you, but would you like to talk about jobs, retirement, investing, insurance, or healthcare reform, or trillion dollars? This whole trillion dollar number is fascinating to me, but I wanted to pick something that you actually wanted to talk about.
I think I would like to talk about spending because it's the only thing you can control. And what you spending is everything. Spending is your retirement. Spending is your house. Spending is everything. I think that we all need to really get back to where we are comfortable with what's coming out of our pocket, and what's coming out of our pocket is less than what's going into our pocket every month. And if we don't have the money, we can't. That's the whole part of if you can't afford it, put it down. I'm not saying be a cheapskate. The USA Today, the headline of the review for me said, you know, Christine Romans' new book will coax the inner cheapskate out of you. And I was like, no. Afford it, buy it. The economy wants it. If you can afford it and it's good for your family, then do it. But if you can't afford it, put it down. And we have to know again what it is that we can and can't afford and make these priorities. And I've done some radio interviews heading into the holidays about this because people have been sort of saying, come on, you mean no presents for Christmas? And I said, no, I do mean presents for Christmas. But my grandfather always said hunger is the best sauce. And we haven't been hungry in this country for a very long time. And we started to forget things didn't taste good anymore because we had whatever we wanted. And now we need to get back to where it's a few important gifts. It's an important time. It's for a birthday even, you know, like I remember exactly what I got in fourth grade for Christmas. I mean, I got a tape recorder and I got this really like fuzzy shawl. I know exactly what I got because I waited for it and wanted it and loved it. But kids now get stuff all the time. They get stuff all the time. You know, you don't, and I, even as a mom, I've done it, and I'm not trying to be high and mighty. I've done it too, where I see something like a cute little kitchen set and I think, oh, I'm going to put that in the basement. You know, it's a Costco, it's $100. I buy it, put it in the basement. You know, well then what? You know, now what? So I'm really, in my own life and in my book, really trying to show that I really think that less is more. And let everybody else spend money like crazy to hold up the economy. But I think every family should really be looking inward on their spending. That's what I think is so important.
My husband said the same thing you just said before we went on air. He said, tell her I said less is more, less is more. I know I'm old, but less is more. He's 52 years old. And
I think that Leonardo da Vinci said that simplicity is the ultimate luxury. And that might not be the exact wording, but that's a really interesting way to think of it. You know, simplicity is the ultimate luxury. And if you think about how you're paying for your retirement and you're putting money away for student loans and you're building a future and building wealth and comfort in the bank. And I love savings. I'm a big proponent of savings. I hate it that you get nothing for saving now. In fact, you're probably paying the bank to hold your money because interest rates are so low.
Right.
But just building that cushion is so important that that to me is such a luxury. That's so much more important than another car in the garage.
Yeah. How do you I remember when I was, you know, 20 years ago, back in my 20s, and I started getting charge cards in the mail. And I started charging on the charge cards. And, oh, it was so fun. And before I knew it, I'm like, oh, my goodness, I have $15,000 in debt. And I was in college, and I charged some tuition on there and some books. And whatever I needed to survive, I put on those cards. And thank goodness for my ex-husband, I hate calling him that, but my spouse, formerly known as Michael, his parents paid off our charge cards. But how do you, if you were in that mode of spend, how do you stop?
Yeah, well, you know what, the thing is that healthcare reform also stopped that for college kids because now there are laws against college kids getting those solicitations, and there's also laws against college kids. If you are under 21, you can't even open a credit card anymore unless you have a co-signer as a parent. Yep, that was also in healthcare reform. So, all of us who got one when we were 20 and, you know, went to Express and Limited and bought a cute new outfit, you know, as soon as we could. They can't, a college sophomore can't do that anymore. They have to have a parent sign for them, or they have to show income. A college kid can get a credit card if they show if they can show income, because the bank wants to know they're going to be paid back. So new rules make it pretty interesting. Yeah, but it's hard. I mean, once you get the taste of it, it's hard to live. Once you get the taste of credit, it's hard not to use it. But this time, I guess they're making it a lot more difficult to use credit. That's for sure.
So, Katie, with 2 minutes left, do you have anything you wanted to ask? I know you wanted to ask the sandwich generation.
I'm one of those sandwich people. I'm power of attorney for my older mom, and I'm also mother of an 8-year-old. So I'm caught in the middle of two worlds, and it's quite overwhelming at times. And I wanted you to speak to that about, you know, helping estate planning for your elderly parent. I'm just gone through that process with my siblings, and I didn't know if you had any thoughts about that.
I think it's an incredibly, and I'll tell you something, that it's usually women who are the people who bear the biggest burden in the sandwich generation, for the whole sandwich thing. And that is, the sandwich generation is you are caring for two generations at once. You're stuck in the middle, and you're trying to plan for your own retirement and save for yourself – At the same time, you're paying for two other generations, or you are responsible for two other generations. And it's a tough spot to be in. The most important thing for you is whatever is happening, keep planning for your own retirement so that you don't get in a situation where you're 92 and your darling children are taking care of you, or you're not in a comfortable, good position. So the best piece of advice about the sandwich generation is don't deny yourself while you're so selflessly taking care of other people, because a lot of people deny themselves and they get in trouble. So pay yourself first and then take care of everyone else. That would be my biggest piece of advice. It's hard to do, and it seems like it's not fair or it's selfish, but it's not. It's better for everyone if you make sure you take care of yourself first.
That was awesome in 90 seconds, and we have 20 seconds left of the show. So buy the book,
Smart is the New Rich.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for helping. Yeah, definitely. And you can buy that anywhere across the country, and you can join, you know, what day are you? You're on CNN, and we can catch you on there all the time, and you can find you on social media, and I thank you. It has been a joy having you with us today.
Thanks, ladies.
Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
Bye, guys. Thanks a lot. That was
fun.
Everyone. Have a great afternoon. Bye.
All right.
Bye.
Have a better day. Bye.
Bye.